Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Louis Friedberg, director of California Watch, a program of the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley, and your moderator for today's event. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. To further discuss Commonwealth Club programs, please visit the club's blog at commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. Our focus today will be the multiple challenges facing the California news media and what this means for the democratic process in the state. At precisely the time California is experiencing its worst budget crisis and governance crisis in decades, the California news media are also struggling to cope with a collapsing business model and widespread layoffs. They're also competing for the attention of Californians from 24-hour cable channels, talk shows, and a constant stream of often unfiltered information on the internet. All these developments raise troubling questions about how Californians will be informed and engaged in key issues affecting the state. Today we will look at the issue of who will hold California's institutions, both public and private, accountable, and at some of the new journalism models that are emerging on a transformed media landscape. To that end, I'm pleased to introduce today's distinguished panel. On my left is David Lauder. He's an assistant managing editor at the LA Times. He oversees the paper's California coverage, and I want to thank him for coming up from LA today. David has been at the LA Times for more than two decades. Like me, he's a former Washington correspondent, and he's covered two presidential campaigns. He oversaw coverage of the 2003 gubernatorial recall campaign here in California and the LA wildfires that year, which won a Pulitzer Prize. Next to him is Martin Reynolds. He's the editor of the Oakland Tribune. He's a Berkeley native, a graduate of Berkeley High School, and I'm proud to say that I've known him since he was 12 years old. And it's great to see him fighting the good fight in journalism today. Next to him is Sandy Close, who is executive editor of New America Media, the first and largest national collaboration of some 2,000 ethnic news organizations, including many here in California. She's been executive editor of Pacific News Service since 1974 and has pioneered several media innovations, including YO, or Youth Outlook, and The Beat Within, which is a journal of written by incarcerated youth in California. Next to Sandy is Stuart Drown. He's executive director of the Little Hoover Commission, a 50-year-old state agency that has done remarkable work over the years investigating a range of solutions and challenges facing the state and making recommendations to the legislature. Stuart is also a veteran journalist. Until 2006, when he joined the commission, he worked at the Sacramento Bee as both its business editor and city editor. And at the end of the table is Mark Katchis. He is editorial director of California Watch, where I also work. And California Watch is a new journalism venture based at the Center for Investigative Reporting, underwritten by the Hewlett, Irvine, and Knight Foundations. Mark is a California native and also a veteran California investigative reporter and editor at, among other newspapers, the Orange County Register, and most recently at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, before returning this year to his home state, which is a lot warmer than where he was before. So let me start with David Lauder from the LA Times. David, the LA Times is still the dominant newspaper in California, but you've also gone through significant layoffs. I'm wondering, to what extent do you experience what's happening in the media generally as a crisis at your newspaper? And how has this affected your coverage of California?
Well, first let me say thank you for the Commonwealth Club for hosting this and for inviting me. It's an important topic. I try to stay away from declaring crises. I think for an individual, it's a crisis when they lose their job. For the news media, there's a problem. The economic model that has sustained large news gathering companies for the last all of my life and longer is falling apart, and there's a need to come up with a new way of making sure that people get paid to do the kind of journalism that we think is important for the future of our state and our democracy. And right now, every news organization in the country is dealing with the outfall of that economic problem. What it means in terms of coverage is two things. What we've tried to do, and I think have done with some success, is to try to, as the staff has gotten smaller, focus our resources on what we think are the most important issues and the most important stories. So we actually have more reporters now on long-term investigative and enterprise work than we had a couple of years ago. Even though the staff is smaller, we have about a dozen currently working on long-term investigative stories that I think will be of great interest to our readers, both in Los Angeles and statewide. Our website actually gets more traffic from the San Francisco area than any other area outside of Los Angeles, which is nice to see. But that does require some choices. If you're going to do that, there are other things that you can't do. And one of the things that we don't do nearly as much as we used to is covering local news, in particular in some of the suburban areas around Los Angeles, which used to take a lot of staff resources. Unfortunately, the smaller local papers that are in those areas have also cut way back. So it's not so much that the big issues don't get covered, because I think they continue to get examined. What goes without coverage, and I think it's a very dangerous thing, is what local officials are doing, either in their own cities or in Sacramento, where many members of the Senate and the Assembly can go without any scrutiny at all for their entire terms, because the local papers that used to cover them are no longer paying any attention, and papers like ours, which have, you know, we've got half the members of the Assembly in our circulation area, so we can't keep tabs on every single one of them on a day-to-day basis. That, I think, is the biggest single gap, and I think there's a huge gap in accountability as a result. And that, to me, is, well, maybe not a crisis, it's certainly a problem facing the state and facing our news media.
Well, let me ask Martin Reynolds from the Oakland Tribune. Martin, you're work at a much smaller paper, although it is part of this large chain. In fact, the largest chain of newspapers, Media News, which owns dozens of newspapers around the state. Mm-hmm. How are you experiencing what's happening as a crisis, and how are you dealing with this? Because obviously you have far fewer resources than the LA Times has. Far fewer.
Yes, that's true. The challenge that we're facing as a newspaper group, which has 11 daily papers, which were part of the Bay Area News Group East Bay, and then you also have, as also part of the big family, there is also the Mercury News, which was acquired a couple of years ago when the Knight went under and McClatchy purchased the papers, and then Media News stepped up and bought a number of those papers for it in a $1.5 billion deal. Since then, what's really happened is the consolidation of those reporters, and there are few people at the state level. We have 2.7 million readers throughout the entire Bay Area News Group and two reporters in Sacramento. I think that that's probably not, 1.35 million people per reporter. And so I think that the problem that you have there is you have to really pick your battles. What are you going to focus your resources on, and where are you going to direct those resources? And I think it's impossible to think that two reporters can possibly run around and cover all of the issues, all of the individuals, the concerns that are facing this size of a readership. And I think what happens on the local level is that you have to, as an editor of a paper that certainly has concerns about what's going on at the state level, I don't have the resources to really direct my focus there. So what ends up happening is your scope gets smaller. You begin to focus those things at the county level, whereas otherwise, back some years ago when I came to the Tribune, we still had reporters that still were looking up at the state level. So what's happened is we've got these reporters are up here, and oftentimes what they're looking at, they're thinking, okay, I've got to write these issues for the larger group. And there may be particular issues that are poignant for a particular newspaper in the group, but oftentimes now that reporter doesn't have the ability to sort of bring it home for that paper. And at the local level, we're sort of looking up, and how are we going to create sort of the synergy between the local reporting output and that state level, and it's very difficult. So I think what ends up happening is you begin to lose some measure of perspective that you once had of how local issues are affected at the state level and then how those state level issues really come home to your local readership.
Well, let me jump to Stuart Drown from the Little Hoover Commission. I mean, Stuart, you're a former journalist, so you're probably still following closely how your colleagues are covering these issues and what impact it's having. You're now kind of in state government. Do you see that this downsizing that we've been talking about, is that noticed? Do you see that this has less of an impact in Sacramento on policymakers? How do things look from where you sit?
Well, it's changing. Let me first say that I'm not speaking now for the commission. I'm speaking as a former journalist. What I've seen is when I moved over to government, Schwarzenegger had just been had come into office, and the Capitol was swelled with reporters, TV, press, and there were something like 400 credentialed journalists in the town, and now that's down to less than 100. And so bureaus that had been very big, San Jose Mercury News, the San Francisco Chronicle, they've shrunk tremendously. And so those reporters are going from press conference to press conference or dealing with a press release, and so you don't have the depth of the stories that you had before. And what that has done is you get kind of the top level of a story, and the reporters don't have the opportunity to go back and put things in context or extract the larger meaning out of this and go to these broader macro stories of how something at the state level is affecting things on a local level. And for me, what I've seen, our commission looks at issues that are invariably very controversial, and right now we're looking at water and in-home supportive services. And so what's happened is with kind of episodic coverage from the mainstream press, and that's not very deep, it's allowed kind of more of the chatter, uninformed chatter, to take up the debate space. And so it allows a lot of kind of uninformed ideas and opinions take up more of the bandwidth of audiences than it used to in the past. And so it kind of degrades a lot of the policy debates.
And isn't it the case that you, the Little Hoover Commission and some other agencies in government, oversight agencies, actually hiring former journalists or laid-off journalists?
Absolutely. And many of my former colleagues, and I've hired two former reporters, one out of a bureau that was there and one who had been on my staff, and then several of the folks that had worked for me are now in state government, and some of them are in watchdog roles, which is encouraging. But there's nothing like an independent, outside, non-government watchdog, and that's what we rely on the press for.
But could you just, what skills do those journalists bring that they can actually now use that for these oversight agencies?
Well, first and foremost is a sense of skepticism and a complete lack of deference to authority, which is useful. And they can think fast and they can write fast and they can separate out good arguments from bad arguments. And I think the willingness to take a fresh look at something and the willingness to evaluate it on its basis and not just who it's coming from, I think, are extraordinarily important.
Well, this is a good segue to Mark Katchis of California Watch. You're working for one of the new nonprofit journalism organizations that are emerging not only in California but nationwide. I'm wondering if you could just fill us in a little bit about what you think, why you think what you are doing or California Watch is doing is necessary. In other words, you know, what holes are you trying to fill
right
with the work of California Watch?
Well, I think what we've heard already is that there are fewer people watching. There are fewer people minding the store, journalists in California. And although, you know, folks like the Los Angeles Times are still a an amazing outfit, a formidable news organization, one of the best in the world. And they can make the types of decisions that David's talking about where they can still do terrific investigative and enterprise journalism. A lot of other news organizations are simply struggling to cover the basic news. And there is a void. And I think what California Watch can be and has been is an organization that can help fill that void. We've created, over the course of the last several months, the largest investigative team in the state. We've partnered with over 40 news organizations in California to develop, produce, and deliver high-end enterprise watchdog and investigative stories. The San Francisco Chronicle has taken six of our stories in the last couple of months alone, running them on the front page, every single one of them. But what we're trying to do is reach the broadest type of audience we possibly can. So a day that the San Francisco Chronicle may run one of our stories, it will also probably appear in the Sacramento Bee or possibly the Orange County Register or the San Diego Union-Tribune. We're looking to forge partnerships with a broad array of newspapers, and also public radio. KQED Radio is a partner of ours, and local television as well.
And just to clarify about the LA Times, you still have a number of investigative reporters, but your staff has been cut from, it was the high of 1,250 reporters?
Well, it was never 1,250 reporters.
Well,
it was 1,200
newsroom staff. Mm-hmm.
1,250 reporters would be a great luxury.
Yeah. But today it's approximately
The overall staff has been cut about in half, but the reporting staff has been cut a lot less than that. I mean, we've lost a lot of copy editors, designers, people who lay out pages, researchers, all of whom contribute heavily to what we try to do. But we have tried as much as possible, as the staff has been cut, to minimize the loss of reporters, which is not to say that we haven't lost reporters, because we have, but the percentage decrease is considerably smaller than that.
Well, let me turn to Sandy Close from New American Media. Sandy, one of the major challenges for news media in California is, how do you cover a state the size of California? It's so diverse, and, you know, actually, arguably, California is more than one state. I mean, maybe four states or five states. But how does one reach all Californians? And what is the role of the ethnic media in doing that?
You know, I'm always struck by how we in journalism love to pronounce the death of things. We pronounce the death of irony after 9/11. We pronounce the death of literature. We pronounce the death of media. In fact, ethnic media, the largest news-consuming audience in the Bay Area, and indeed in Los Angeles and the Central Valley, is the audience that watches Univision. The largest consumer of newspaper news is the Chinese, Vietnamese, and Korean media consumers. And these media, in fact, the what we call the ethnic media, as if somehow they're very parochial, they're not, have seen their audiences grow as mainstream media has had to cut back. So you have a 16% growth in audience over the last 5 years by ethnic media across the country. Even in an area which has probably the worst ravages of the recession, the Central Valley and the Inland Empire, you have a phenomenal resurgence of ethnic media. The Hmong Tribune has just resurfaced. A new black talk radio has just started. A Chinese language newspaper in San Bernardino and a Chinese language television station run by people who've mortgaged two houses to pay for it. So I've been very impressed by what I think is the backstory of our failure in mainstream media, which we too often attribute to a failed business model. Indeed, I think it was much deeper than that, and I implicate myself in it. We could not figure out, as our state became more and more of a global society, how to encompass it. And now we discuss government. How do we make government accountable? My question is, how does government govern if it can't communicate with, can't reflect, and doesn't know about vast stretches of our state that are now more or less invisible to what we call media, the news media? I think if it weren't for the polling that the field poll is now conducting in multiple languages, for the first time in Asian languages as well as Spanish, we would have a hard time as people in the public sector understanding what the perspectives are of the emerging majority of the state.
Let me just remind everyone that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Today we're discussing the crises in California media and to what extent media organizations can hold public and private institutions accountable. Our panelists are David Lauder, assistant managing editor from the Los Angeles Times, Martin Reynolds, who is editor of the Oakland Tribune, Sandy Close, executive director of New America Media, Stuart Drown, executive director of the Little Hoover Commission, and Mark Katches, editorial director of California Watch, and I'm Louis Friedberg, director of California Watch. I do have to throw out this, Stuart.
I just wanted to follow up on something that Sandy said in terms of accountability. I mean, that's for the Little Hoover Commission. That is a very big part of what we try to do. And you know, we talk a lot about on the staff, all the former journalists, about what new models would be could help spread accountability and. One of the things we talk about is the role of the press, you know, not only in stories but in terms of process of opening up access or and allowing readers or listeners to become part of the accountability process by opening up government to them, which is, you know, getting data online, directing them to reports. You know, we have a huge, if possibly founded confidence in you know, this Web 2.0 to get data out there, to have intelligent people evaluate it for themselves and then feed that back into the conversation. You know, that would be something that a lot of people, I think, would be very excited about.
Well, let me ask you, because one thing that which is really new on the landscape is this concept of a citizen journalist. And, you know, the issue has been raised, you know, to what extent, you know, can't citizen journalists fill a lot of the void? In fact, in some cases they are. They are actually coming up with stories that the mainstream media has to kind of follow, as we saw in the presidential campaign.
Well, one of the great things that's happening now is that within the media sector, there's extraordinary collaboration that didn't exist before, and it's represented by CIR's collaboration.
Center for Investigative Reporting.
Exactly, and it's represented by the LA Times running a poll we just did in Creole and English of Haitian Americans. It would have been more difficult to break through those silos before, but probably the best example was the Chauncey Bailey project that Martin was absolutely critical for. It was a collaboration of 23 news organizations. The idea that any one of us now could have a handle on the complexity of this state, much less rely on citizen journalists who, by and large, are reflective of really only a narrow sector of California's very diverse and fragmented society. I think ethnic media's survival has largely depended on what we now call citizen journalism, but it's really people willing to work in a very dedicated fashion. And in fact, a survey that San Francisco State took of ethnic media in the state found that over 68% said their primary mission was to serve their community. Only a third mentioned business and earning revenue as a goal. So citizen journalism, we too often think of in a very narrow way as these swarms of people who are going to inform us. Actually, we inform each other when we collaborate, as we did with the Oakland Tribune and others on this panel.
You know, I think another...
Martin Reynolds at the Tribune.
I think another form of revenue that will be coming into news organizations is from the philanthropic community, specifically those foundations that have a particular interest in a particular area, whether it's health, whether it's politics, whether it's it could be any number of things. And what I've been having some discussions with folks from the philanthropic community is that concept of endowed beats. Does a foundation step in, offer an amount of money to cover, to pay for the coverage of a particular issue? And this obviously raises some issues and some concerns in newsrooms. I think right now, for instance, right now the Oakland Tribune just received a grant in partnership with the Maynard Institute to run a community correspondence program out of the West Oakland branch of the Oakland Public Library. And this is going to be a very exciting project, but I don't know that it's necessarily intended. Well, I can tell you it's not intended to sort of take the place of experienced, steep journalists. It's really intended to sort of give an opportunity for those people in the community that often have felt disenfranchised and not listened to. Gives them a chance to get training that they would never otherwise likely get for no money, also a little bit of cash in their pocket, and an opportunity to have their stories, sort of what some call the pots and pans stories of neighborhoods and communities, told and featured in a way. But there's also talk about getting money for much more experienced journalists to hire them to come in and cover issues of health and wealth disparities and those sorts of things. And so I think that's an issue that the journalism community as a whole is going to have to discuss. And, you know, there are rather strong personalities in those. And
yeah, I think I want to get back to the whole funding model, before the end of the program. But I didn't want to let go of the citizen journalism issue because that's such a crucial part of the discussion now. I was interested to get David Lauder's thoughts on that from where you sit.
Well, I think the key thing for news organizations is figuring out what's our unique role. What is it that we can do that other people can't? Because there are a lot of things that citizen journalists can do and are doing and uncovering a lot of interesting stories. So the question is, what are the things that are unique that we can do? And I think, to my mind, the key answer is that what we can bring that a citizen journalist usually can't is what I call the heavy lift. You know, if someone is doing it on his own dime or her own dime, there's only so much time and effort and money that they can put in before they go broke. We're in court practically every week suing some government agency that's trying to prevent information from getting out to the public. And by the way, every day there's a bill introduced in the legislature to block public access to one thing or another. So that's something that as citizens or citizen journalists, we ought to be concerned about. So we can do that sort of thing. Data, which you mentioned before, there's a huge amount of data out there. A lot of it is very hard for people to do anything with. So we can try to pull it together and make it available to people in ways that they can actually use and understand. That kind of work is something that's very hard for an individual to do because it requires programming and a lot of work that a lot of people don't have time to do. So and then there are the longer term investigative stories where you're putting someone on a story for 6 months or 3 months or whatever and having them go deeply into an issue, which is something that often an individual citizen journalist is not going to have the time to do. So I think what we need to do as news organizations is define our role in this new emerging media universe and focus our efforts as much as possible on the things that we can do that others can't. And that, I think, is the way that we will continue to continue to attract readers in the decades to come.
Let me ask a question from the floor, and it's a panel of journalists here, so I hope they don't get too defensive, but this is the question. Where was the California press while our legislature has been driving us into insolvency? It seems like they were cheerleading every step of the way. Why no investigative reporting on the moral hazards of unfunded liabilities, skyrocketing payroll, staffing expenses, etc.? I'll just throw that open to
Well, I guess I would challenge the premise. I mean, I think, I know, in fact, that we've written...
This is David Loud of the LA Times.
We've written extensively on every single one of those points. It's unfortunately, you know, you can put a story in the newspaper. You can't force people to read it.
Any other... Mark?
No, I think David's right. Those stories are probably getting done. I don't know if they're getting done enough, frankly. They're very dense topics, and frankly, with a diminishing news hole, stories like that take length and time and space to tell. And not only are news staff shrinking in California, but the news hole is shrinking dramatically. There are far, well, you probably all subscribe to papers around here, and you could see... For yourself, that they are shrinking. And stories that maybe 5 years ago, 100 column inches could have gotten into the newspaper. Today, newspapers are struggling to get 50 column inches into a newspaper. The Times is an exception. But others are really struggling mightily to tell those very dense, complicated stories.
And, yeah, something that I've noticed is that, you know, as the news landscape gets so fragmented, that it becomes harder and harder for one news outlet or one news story to kind of really penetrate. And so you can actually have good reporting at local outlets, but it doesn't kind of rise to the surface and get noticed. I don't think there's been a scientific study, but I think that, you know, good reporting often, you know, with fewer outlets in the past probably was noticed more. Mark?
Yeah, and just one last thing I'll say. We've produced, in our short lifespan of California Watch, we've produced 9 stories now. And many of those stories are well over 100 inches, really long stories, and we're putting them at full length on our website. But no newspaper in California has run a full-length version of anything we've produced. We've had to produce stories at different lengths, sometimes 3 different lengths, to get it out there. And in some places, they're running a third of what we produce. In other places, they're running half of what we produce. And just last week, we had a story that was probably 135 inches as it appeared on our website. But we were being asked through the week by partners, can we cut this, can we cut that? So that's a reality.
I also think the way those stories are told is an
issue
as well.
Martin Reynolds from the
What sometimes we often talk about in the news meeting is don't write a story that's longer than it has to be, and I'm not at all implying that that should be shorter, but I'm saying that a story that's 135 inches, we're living in a society where people, they may want to sit down and read a 135-inch story, but let's be real. I don't think it's going to happen. So, and so there's all this blood, sweat, and tears that goes into putting a story like that together, hours and hours of reporting and editing and research that California Watch and others do. So the question then becomes, well, how do we then take that information and perhaps package it in a way that is easily digestible for folks who they can look at it? Maybe it's non-narrative. Maybe it's more graphic. So I think as a news organization, we also have to reflect on how we present information. And so can it be a narrative? Can it be a 50-inch story with something that people can look at and get? And so,
yeah. Well, that raises just a Stuart, you had a quick comment?
Well, now that I'm outside of the game, I just want to emphasize to this audience that, you know, the reporting work that goes into those stories is extraordinary. I mean, it's physically, emotionally, and intellectually demanding. But the process that starts after that, that is largely invisible, is extremely demanding as well. It takes a great deal of sophistication. And as newsrooms are pressed, you lose the time that editors and, you know, the whole packaging process has. And that is not an insignificant problem.
I'm struck, Lewis, by something Martin said that it reminds me of a piece that was in the Science Times a couple of weeks ago about what are the stories in the Times over a six-month period that are most frequently emailed. It's a story by John Tierney, and it was
the New York Times.
Yes, and it was based on a study by the University of Pennsylvania. Stories that are most frequently emailed are stories that give people a sense of the wider context, that inspire them to see something that they had totally not understood, even though they had taken it for granted. They're stories that the the scholars described as awe-inspiring. They weren't the sex stories. They weren't the scandal stories. They were the stories that informed people and expanded their imagination about the world. And I was heartened, I have to say, by that. I think we want to know how to understand what's happening at the legislative level. And they tell us, how many of you have seen this, that the California is now a failed state. That was actually a New York Times editorial, that California is a failed state. Who's failed? Certainly not the kids lining up on 19th Avenue as the buses go by full and there are not enough of them to get to state. They want to go and live their California dream. But the legislature, the bureaucrats in Sacramento have somehow decided, they failed to live up to those dreams and to connect to and embrace the energy of this state. Now, how do we cover that? If we just cover this as a question of legislative, policy making full of wonk words, no, nobody's going to read it. But we have to somehow link the dreams, ambitions, and experiences of the people in this state with the people who are supposed to be representing them and see where that breakdown is. Instead of allowing Sacramento and the government and their failures to define us as a failed state.
I just want to remind you that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Today we are discussing the crisis in California media and how media organizations can hold public and private institutions accountable. Our panelists are David Lauder, Assistant Managing Editor at the Los Angeles Times, Martin Reynolds, Editor of the Oakland Tribune, Sandy Close, who's Executive Director of New America Media, Stuart Drown, is Executive Director of the Little Hoover Commission, and Mark Katchus, Editorial Director of California Watch, and I'm Louis Friedberg. Sandy's comment leads me to, I just want to turn this a little bit on its head. I think a lot of people want the media to act in the public interest. But as I think it was Jim Bettinger at Stanford in the night programs asked or responded, is the public interested? Isn't that a huge challenge, how to engage Californians, as opposed to the small group of people who are really working for reforms and the Constitutional Convention and redistricting and so on? How do you get people at the grassroots engaged in these issues? And are there any new kind of techniques that are emerging that, to get them involved? Stuart, I see you.
I'd like to follow on Sandy's comment and recall a story that I thought might be appropriate here, but also to note that we're in a changed journalism environment, and a lot of the old roles and a lot of the old constructs that journalists used to put on themselves, I think you've got the freedom now to chunk. And one of them is, I think readers want to know that journalists are for something. I was talking about this with colleagues, they want to know that they're for saving California. And I don't think that is something that they should be embarrassed about saying. But I think there's too often the sense of between readers or their view of journalists. I've certainly heard a lot about what people think about journalists now that they feel free to talk to me about it, is that they don't feel they feel there's an element of nihilism, like you don't really care, you're not really invested in this, you pretend that you're not part of the community. There's this sense of distance, and I think if news organizations made it clear that no, despite all the things they do for communities in the state and the editorial pages and the columnists. To say that, yeah, we are actually for something. We want California to be a better place. To go to Sandy's point, there was a very influential piece that the Philadelphia Inquirer did probably in the early 90s, America, What Went Wrong? And so this was something that ran out in Knight Ridder papers and lots of other papers across the country, and it ended up being a paperback book. That's something I think readers would be, and that would have to be a group project at this point, California, What Went Wrong, to lay it out to readers, because a lot of readers are happy having things both ways, saying we want to be everybody tough on crime, but we don't want to pay for prisons. And I think we got to put it out there. You can't have it both ways. That all these people are Californians, and we're going to have to deal with them one way or another.
You know, I also think that news.
Martin Reynolds, Open Tribune.
News organizations and newspaper journalists, we've done a very bad job at marketing. We live in a society that is, I mean, people watch the Super Bowl for the commercials. And we live in a society where that resonates. And what have we as journalists done to distinguish ourselves from sort of the static that's out there, from the blogosphere, from information or outlets that may not be reputable or may not provide folks with the accountable information that they need? So sort of where is the journalistic equivalent to the Got Milk campaign, Got Journalism? And I've been sort of screaming at this for a long time, being in my other life as a musician. You know, music is all about marketing. It's not necessarily about talent. And so as news organizations, what have we done to sort of go into these communities and to say, hey, this is why we're important, this is why you should care, and this is what we're about? It's sort of this reporting from the ivory tower philosophy, which I think doesn't make any damn sense at all.
Sure. Could I add to that one thought? I was struck by a piece in the black newspaper in San Bernardino that said that the San Bernardino Riverside would soon have the highest number of elders over 65 of any area in the country. California will have the largest population of elders of any state, perhaps not surprisingly. But I think of what we could accomplish as a collaborative to look at evictions of elders in this time of foreclosure. That's something you think of what gave Sarah Palin's death panel resonance. It was probably the sharpest rhetorical edge I've heard from anybody in a year. Death panel. Doesn't matter what she was using it about. Everybody resonated with that. And I'm thinking of elder... I'm elder. I'm thinking of us in this state. And how do we bring our stories to greater visibility, not just as technology is now dividing us into this citizen journal, that blog, this news site, whatever. How do we do it in a way that you understand off Columbus on Jasper Alley? If you read the Tsingtao, you would know this. A Chinese woman, 91, is about to be evicted in a building of 6 apartments that are being converted to tenants in common. Her son, 45, hung himself because he couldn't figure a way to save his mother. That story is the kind of story you could magnify, probably. I'm convinced that story is happening in so many communities. If we added it up, it would make a huge impact, the way Anthem's skyrocketing healthcare charges are making a skyrocketing impact. But we need to connect the society to the government in a more effective way.
I see Mark, you wanted to add a
comment. I wanted to actually build on something that Martin said, and I agree with him 150% about journalists being bad marketers. There's probably not a news organization in California that wouldn't tell you that investigative reporting or watchdog journalism is important to them in their newsroom. They tell their staffs that as well. But they do a really, really horrible job of telling readers that. Being out there and telling them that this is a priority, we are going to do this. They just don't do it enough. And I think there's always been discomfort amongst most journalists about being self-promotional. We don't have that problem at California Watch. We're happy to tell you how good we think we are. But I think that is an issue, and we have to overcome it.
Mark, I think we talk endlessly about ourselves, and we're so preoccupied with ourselves we become a house of mirrors, and we've lost the connection. We've lost the human connection, and that's what put mainstream media in the bind we're in, to message out about how great we are before we discover a way of reconnecting. I don't think makes sense.
Well, I guess I wouldn't say necessarily that the message is how great we are, but what we're doing. What we're trying to do.
Yeah, and I think, Mark, I think you guys are both sort of saying the same thing in a way that you don't necessarily go out and talk, push your chest out there and say how grandiose you are, but you're going out and I think engaging. I mean, one of the things, Bob Maynard was the former publisher of the Oakland Tribune, and one of the things that he did was out 3 days a week in the community. It was a time when the Oakland Tribune was really connected with the community. And it's because he went out and explained what he was doing, what was important, what the paper was about, and was accessible to the community. And I think as an industry as a whole, we could take that sort of granular example and bring it on a much larger example and say, hey, this is what we're about, and do a better job. I mean, I think also journalists have been very, you know, so this whole objective journalism kind of concept that we just, you know, we're just the flies on the wall and we're just buzzing around and we're going to, I think as a news organization, you have to decide what are we going to be about, what's our focus going to be about, and then to that, you of course apply all the journalistic standards that you would. And I think when you take a stand journalistically, I think a community, and it's one that resonates with a community, I think you connect with that community.
And if I can just say, you know, I'm sitting here with a stack of questions from the audience here, and I'd like to get as many of these answered. So I'd encourage the panelists to keep their responses short, even though this is a complicated issue. You know, one of the things that is encouraging to me is audiences like this, that people in general, even though they might be canceling their newspaper subscriptions or you know, getting the news from John Stewart, or people care. A lot of people care about what is happening to the news industry, and they want to see good journalism. And I think, you know, the audience here today is testimony to that. I do want to try to focus a little bit on some of the new kind of journalism models that are emerging, or I don't know, models, though that's probably a little grandiose. But I do have a question here. What do you think about the Bay Area News Project, which is the new venture that Warren Hellman is underwriting here in the Bay Area? It's going to be a news organization online news organization will also supply news to the local Bay Area pages of the New York Times. Sandy?
I can't resist this. I've been watching the New York Times Bay Area sections, and if you would believe the New York Times, the Bay Area has become gourmet ghetto. We are defined by our restaurants. Mm-hmm. Berkeley is no longer Berkeley of the political vanguard. It's Berkeley of Chez Panisse. I am just completely stunned by somehow, it's as if we've totally lost our rhetorical edge for the left. It's no longer what we express, it's what we put on our mouths. And somehow the Bay Area has just become consumed with coverage. How does New York know us? You know, by our restaurants. And I have to say, I think we're more than that, but I am struck by that. And well, I hope Warren's group goes beyond that.
Yeah. The New York Times once described Englewood in a story as being 8 miles due south of Beverly Hills. So, you know, the people write for their audience. As an outsider to the Bay Area, so I don't have a dog in this particular fight.
This is David Lowder from the Times.
I think, you know, the more players, the better. There is a shortage of people covering news of all sorts in all sorts of parts of California. So the more people who want to jump in, whether it's philanthropic or individual citizen journalists or companies or whatever, I think it's all good. I don't think any one of these things is going to be the silver bullet that solves everyone's problems. But I think the more the merrier.
I think it's a really good
Martin
thing.
Martin Reynolds. Yeah.
I'm actually excited about that. It's one of the things in my organization that I feel is really needed, sort of some new direction. We've done some partnering with Spot.us, David Cohn's project. We're also, as I mentioned, our community correspondence program. We've partnered with San Francisco State University and UC Berkeley to create student news bureaus so that we actually have students covering various issues, and they come into our newsrooms, and we've even given some of those folks jobs. And so one of those students, Ashan Maher, young guy, And he just, the sort of new energy and perspective that he brings to a newsroom is really important. And it's an opportunity to sort of, and we've also partnered with Sandy Close and Youth Outlook. And so I think that what you have to have in organizations is someone and a willingness to embrace that. I don't think, as David points out, I don't think you should look at it as something bad like, oh, my God, Hellman's coming. What are we going to do? I think you look at it as, okay, great. Someone else is doing that. What can we do to step up? News organizations, the model, newspapers have been so successful for so long. It's not like we're Toyota or Apple where we have to change and evolve constantly to stay competitive. It's been successful. Now, all of a sudden, it all happened like at one time. And then the recession hit. And so I don't think in news organizations there was a culture of change, a culture of growth. And now we're sort of being forced all at the same time. And it's a good thing.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing the crisis in California media and to what extent media organizations can hold public and private institutions accountable. Just to remind you that our panelists are David Lauder, Assistant Managing Editor of the LA Times, Martin Reynolds, Editor of the Oakland Tribune, Sandy Close, Executive Director of New America Media, Stuart Drown, Executive Director of the Little Hoover Commission, and Mark Katchis, Editorial Director of California Watch, and I'm Louis Friedberg. This is kind of segued a little bit into the funding issue. I'm going to ask this, if we could just get this, we could spend a whole day discussing this. One of the questions here is, why not charge for online news? And I'll ask David, you guys at the LA Times, you guys, you know, you have millions, is it 12 million unique visitors a month? And you don't charge.
A little more than that, actually. But we're all looking at that. Here's the dilemma. Last year, we had 1.6 billion page views on latimes.com. You get a certain amount of revenue each time someone clicks on a page. So if you charge, how much of that are you going to lose? Are you going to lose 0.6 billion? Are you going to lose 1 billion? Are you going to lose 90% of it? Nobody really knows what the how much of that traffic would go away if you started to charge for it. And therefore, we don't really know how much of the revenue that we currently get through advertising would go away with the traffic, and whether, you know, can you make that up by charging people for the experience of reading your stories online? It's a leap into the unknown, and as Martin said, newspapers don't exactly have a culture of change, so leaps into the unknown make publishers very nervous. That being said, I think people increasingly are running out of options, so that's making them more willing to take the leap, and I think some organizations will make the leap. I also think as technology changes with things like tablet computers and things like that, it opens up new possibilities.
So just in terms of the funding issue, there was a report that came out a month or two ago. Lynn Downey, former editor at the Washington Post, co-authored it. He proposes that we take the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, take some of the licensing fees for broadcast licenses and so on, set up a fund for local news reporting. I'm wondering if anyone on the panel has any thoughts on the notion of government support for the kind of news we're seeing disappearing in California. Stuart?
I'll answer Stuart this as a former journalist. I think government support of newspapers is a terrible idea. That is a line that should not be crossed.
How does it differ from support for NPR or PBS?
Well, NPR doesn't get government support. PBS does. And I think I agree. I'd rather go broke than take a paycheck from a government agency. Government-run journalism is propaganda. Plain
well,
and simple.
But I think
and it will never be otherwise.
NPR, whether it does get some of its money, does come from the corporate, I don't know, with PBS or CPB, but some of it does get some support. I'm not sure it's had an impact
so
on the coverage.
The BBC?
Well,
Mark Katchis.
I think I agree with Stuart and David as well about government funding, but I also say that if you look in California and probably outside of California, there are news organizations today that are taking government money in the form of retraining grants from state agencies. So it does occur. It's a small amount of money, but it does occur.
And can I throw out a notion? We've talked about collaboration and these new collaborative models that are emerging, but I'm wondering, for example, Sandy Close mentioned the idea of like really focusing on the foreclosure crisis in California. What about this idea? How come news outlets don't get together? The LA Times, the Oakland Tribune, New American Media, California Watch, Sacramento Bee, and assign reporters say, we're going to jointly take on this issue of the foreclosure crisis in California. We're going to work together on this issue, and we're going to come out with a blockbuster series on one day in all these newspapers around the state using the collective resources of these newspapers. I mean, one of the things that I've seen is that while we want to collaborate, there's still the old journalistic culture of wanting to be first and wanting to have that journalism scoop. But isn't that kind of an outdated kind of concept now, given the declining resources and also getting to the issue of having an impact in a state the size of California?
Maybe Martin could talk about how 23 news organizations collaborated to investigate the murder of Chauncey Bailey in Oakland in August 2007 and the subsequent failure of the Oakland Police Department to sufficiently discover what the realities were behind Bailey's death. That took 23 media that were otherwise fiercely competitive but were suddenly aware of the deep social tear that had occurred with Bailey's death. When we see the just huge need to collaborate, I think that for the first time in 40 years, in my experience, there's tremendous willingness among everyone at this table, among many of the people in this room, to pool efforts and serve the public interest. That's what gives me the tremendous hope that this new paradigm will be more inclusive and build more inclusive journalism for the future.
I think you're right, Sandy. I think that what it takes in that moment, what it took was
Martin Reynolds,
an understanding that what we were coming together for was bigger than any one of us. And I think you could argue that in this situation, with the implications of the state and the people in it and what's happening, you could once again make the argument that this issue is larger than any one of us and that we all should come together to come up with these kinds of projects. I would like to say, though, that there are some of those. The APME, which I'm also a board member on, Associated Press Managing Editors Board, I think it was last year or the year before, came together, and there was this whole earmarks project where all of these newspapers did stories simultaneously on congressional earmarks. So there are examples in news organizations do these kinds of projects, but I think it can happen more. I think what it takes in an organization is just some vision and some leadership and some like-minded folks down the road.
Well, then, as Mark mentioned earlier, California Watch has done stories that have appeared in lots of newspapers around the state, so you have that sort of thing. I guess what I would say is there are certain stories in which collaboration is a great thing, and the Chauncey Bailey Project was a terrific example of that. But it's also true that, as in every other walk of life, competition tends to make people better. I always like coming up to the Bay Area because it makes me feel like a right winger. Otherwise, I spend my day having people yell at me for being part of the liberal media. But I believe in competition. I think competition makes people keener, makes their story sharper. And I fear that if we go too far in the direction of, well, everybody's going to do the same thing, that you just end up with sort of a bland kind of mediocrity rather than people out there competing to get the best possible story.
I don't know. That was the argument, however, though. I mean, I understand where you're coming from, and I think competition is good. But that was an argument that a paper that shall remain nameless took for not participating in the Chauncey Bailey Project. And I think that it was unfortunate because while they did some excellent work, I'm talking about the Chronicle, what the hell, might as well say it.
He didn't name the paper.
I was going to name them for you.
That's fine. I don't mind doing it. They're good folks over there. While they did some excellent work themselves on this investigation, without a doubt, and I know that we pushed each other, without a doubt, because we were constantly looking, what are they going to come with? And I know that they certainly were looking over their shoulder. But I think that there was a larger statement, a larger opportunity that was missed, that we as a journalistic community came together to address this. And I think that same philosophy could be applied in spurts, in spots. And I think that we shouldn't ignore that or turn our backs on having that opportunity, because it also says something to the communities that we serve, that we will not sort of ignore the greater good in spite of ourselves and because we want to be competitive.
A quick comment from Mark Kentis.
Well, I'll just say we've all worked in newsrooms where it's hard enough to get people who work in a cubicle next to you to buy into what you're doing, to get people in your own newsroom to collaborate. But I will say that I think Sandy and Martin are absolutely right. There is a climate now that I've never seen before in California where people, news organizations, news executives are seeing collaboration as something that is a good thing that wasn't something they probably would have thought of 2-3 years ago.
And I just want to throw this in the hopper. We haven't talked about this with the broadcast media and television, that there's also interesting collaborations with local television news, which a lot of people have given up on. But in these news organizations, you actually have people who are trying to do good journalism. You just have to find them.
And I'll just add that collaboration is across different news organizations is an extremely difficult thing to pull off. I mean, it is like moving mountains, but it's happening. And I think that's a really positive sign.
I'll give a quick ethnic media example. In Los Angeles, six ethnic news organizations have come together to produce a common hive for hyperlocal news called the LABs, and it's Hispanic, it's Black, it's Asian, Filipino, it's a multitude of ethnic and linguistic silos that are collaborating to expand their own audience's awareness of each other. The Korea Times called me today and said they had just raised $200,000 for relief of Haitians. It's communities knowing about communities, not just knowing about government.
I'm going to ask David Loud a question from the floor, but it's yes, no. I don't know if I give you a maybe, but will large newspapers exist in 5 years? And you're the largest in California.
I think large news.
And isn't your company in bankruptcy or Chapter 11? I mean, the Tribune company?
Yeah, Tribune company has been in Chapter 11 for around 18 months now. Newspapers or news organizations? I mean,
newspapers.
I don't know. I mean, you know, people will continue to print a printed newspaper as long as someone's willing to pay for it. I don't think that's a particularly important question, though. There's no magic about putting ink on paper. I think newsrooms will exist. I think groups of reporters who are producing great journalism will exist. Whether that journalism shows up on a printed product that gets thrown on people's driveways or on an electronic product that people read on a computer screen is sort of irrelevant to me.
We have come to the end of our, or close to the end of our program, and I'm hoping the panelists will stick around to answer some of the questions from the audience because we've still got a thick stack of very provocative questions. But I'm just going to throw this out, 30 seconds. From each one of our panelists, and without, I hope you won't be too Pollyannish, but what do you see as the most optimistic aspect of the news landscape that as it's emerging? Where do you see the greatest sign of hope? Let me start with Mark Kentis at the other end of the table.
I'll be quick. I just think, you know, this collaboration that you're seeing that's hitting every platform is really, truly exciting. Ethnic media, television, radio, newspapers, online organizations working together on stories. It's a very exciting time.
Stuart.
Yeah, I have to say I'm quite optimistic. I'm not optimistic that people will make a lot of money, but I'm optimistic that that there's, you know, as long as there's good stories out there, somebody's going to want to tell those stories, and that's not going to stop. So I just don't know how to pay for it.
As a lover of print media, what makes me my heart flutter is the young people who work with us, most of whom have not done well in school. They've been in the system. And they don't want us to do away with our print magazine, Yo. They insist. They want the heft of print. So as a lover of print journalism, I have to say what you grow up without, you may end up really wanting.
I'm excited about the fact that the millennial generation, there was a study that was done by the Poynter Institute that talked about the millennial generation and its focus and its concerns. And one of the things that stood out to me was that there was a real strong sense of justice that this generation was concerned about. So, and that's something that I hold very dear. And so if folks are concerned about justice and covering those who've been wronged and uncovering the unwrongs, then I think journalism will be okay because those folks are on the way up.
David Lauder.
Journalism is about telling stories. It's about holding up a mirror to daily life and showing people what life really looks like. And what makes me optimistic is that people have a tremendous hunger for that. We find that every day on not only our website, but hundreds of other websites around the country. When you've got a compelling story, the audience flocks to it. People want to read, and they want to be informed about the world around them. And I'm putting that right-wing hat back on again. I'm a sufficient believer in free markets to believe that if there's a huge audience of people who want something and people who want to produce it, someone will find a way to make it pay.
Well, I just hope that a lot of this discussion about collaboration will really be brought to bear on some of the huge challenges facing California. I think all of us who live here, I don't think I certainly haven't experienced the level of crisis the state is going through, you know, in my lifetime. And collaboration sounds good, but the devil is in the details. So I'm hoping we can all work on making it happen, because it does mean changing, you know, very deeply rooted aspects of the journalism culture, which we're making, we're starting on it, but I think it's still a ways to go. So with that, I want to thank our panelists, David Lauder, who's Assistant Managing Editor of the LA Times, Martin Reynolds, Editor of the Oakland Tribune, Sandy Close, Executive Editor of New America Media, Stuart Drown, Executive Director of the Little Hoover Commission, and Mark Katches, Editorial Director of California Watch. We'd also like to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Louis Friedberg, Director of California Watch, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place to be in the know, is adjourned.